All right. Welcome, everybody, to the inaugural Rights Tech Summit. I'm Ned Sherman. This is Paul Sweeting. We're the co-founders of the Rights Tech Initiative, and this is our first event. We're just thrilled to have this group together. It's a cross-media group. We set out to have a summit with no more than 100 people. I think we sold out at exactly 100 people, so we're very excited about the way things turned out. I'm going to say a couple of things kind of logistic-wise. Paul's going to talk a little bit about the purpose and the goals of what we're doing. But let me start by giving a big thanks to our supporting partners. These events cannot be done without the support of companies. So to the Copyright Clearance Center, Plura Vida, Loeb & Loeb, Music Reports, Sound Exchange, Davis Wright & Tremaine, Roe V, SOCAN, MAI, Orange Genius, Lyric Find, Claris IP, IAEL, Transform PR, and the New York State Bar Association. Big round of applause to the group supporting. With every initiative, this is we're a startup, so it means a lot to us that you've all come out here and invested your time in support in what we're doing. We think this is something really special and something that doesn't exist and needs to exist. A comment for anybody: are there any lawyers in the room? Okay, a few, right? If you haven't already and you want CLE credit for your time here, at the far end of the registration table, the New York Bar Association is here, and there's a form you can fill out, and I think there are 5 credits being offered throughout the day. So if you're interested in that, please stop by and get the CLE. Also, there's Wi-Fi open everywhere. There is a password. I think there's a sign right on the...
Yeah, the network is Japan, and the password is one hand clapping, all one word, lowercase.
One hand clapping. It's kind of logistics. We want this to be really social and interactive, so it's a small group purposely. So anytime you have a thought or a question, just put up your hand and speak, please. Let's not kind of treat this as a us and them kind of situation when people are speaking to. I think the more we can kind of round table this as a room, the better for everybody here. Also, you should be getting, if you haven't already in your inbox, a list of everybody who's here. So you'll know who's here and everyone can, hopefully you connect with everybody here. That's the idea about keeping this tight and small. Logistically, we'll be in this room for most of the day with sessions and keynotes and fireside chats. There'll be lunch outside, networking breaks outside. At the end of the day, we'll have cocktails, which will be provided upstairs. So hopefully everyone can join us throughout the day. Now let me turn it over to Paul and talk a little bit about what we're doing here.
Okay, good morning. Welcome, everyone. We're really thrilled that, first of all, we're very grateful that you all could come, and we're thrilled with the mix of folks that we have here. When we set out to do this, our goal was to try to bring together people from different sectors of the media industry, from the rights-based industries, all of whom are wrestling with similar problems around the identification of assets and the management of rights and the collection and accounting of royalties. There are, of course, particular nuances in each sector that are particular to that sector, but there are also a lot of commonalities. And we're hoping, our goal was to try to spark some dialogue across the different silos, and give everyone a chance to get to know folks who are doing similar work to them, but in different parts of the media industry. So we're really thrilled. I'm particularly thrilled. I mean, when we first came up with this idea, I didn't even know who most of your the companies that are in this room are. So it's been an interesting process of discovery for myself, and I'm really thrilled and grateful that you could all be here. Thanks.
Terrific. All right, so we're gonna get started with our first session, restoring registration to the copyright equation. So if the panel group could come on up. There is one panelist, Greg McMullen, who's going to be patching in from Berlin via Skype. And we tested this morning, and it works, so hopefully it'll work now. But we'll patch him in here right now as well. And Larry, I'll turn it over to you to introduce the panel.
Okay.
Nice
to meet you.
To the other page, see?
Is there a technologist in the room?
No, he is.
No.
Perfect. Yeah. Oh, got it. Okay, great. All right, here we go. Oh, yeah. Also, there's for social media purposes, the hashtag is RightsTech. So, RightsTech. All right, Greg.
Hello.
Hey, welcome.
Thank you.
There he is. All right. Thanks, okay. Larry.
All right. Good morning, everybody. I'm Larry Miller. I'm the moderator of your first panel here this morning. As Jim Griffin noted when I walked in and said hello this morning, and I mentioned Jim because I've probably known him longer than I've known anyone else in this room. I was wearing a new hat, and Jim said, noted my new hat, one of the many that I have worn over the years. The principal hat that I wear these days is as a professor and director of the music business program at NYU, New York University. Where we run an undergraduate and graduate program in music business, and we've been doing that for a long time. Although me, only these last several years. One of the things that I've started to do in the last several, since I've been at NYU, is a podcast. And the podcast is called Musonomics, right? M-U-S-O-nomics, available wherever you get your podcasts for free. We started Musonomics last year as a way to be able to tell the stories of the music and culture business in kind of a data-driven and hopefully, compelling way. And one of the stories that we told recently on Musonomics was the story of, not so much the story of Benji Rogers, but the story of blockchain and music, a story that is still very much nascent and in development. And I wanted to do that story because at MIDEM, at the beginning of June, for those of you who are from music or from whatever industries you're in, I imagine that you have the conferences that you go to year after year after year where much of the industry gets together. And often at MIDEM, you will have a particular topic that sort of rises to the top of the agenda where almost everybody is talking about it, and yet almost nobody actually knows what it is that they're talking about. And so I thought, well, maybe we can at least begin to unpack that, and what we did, an episode on blockchain that featured Benji and media rights technologist Bill Rosenblatt, whom many of you know, and others as well. Anyway, I learned a little bit in doing that episode, and perhaps we can learn more today with starting with these experts on the panel. And so rather than having me introduce them, if we could, and I'm going to ask all the panelists, if we could adhere to the wishes of our producers today and keep our introductions to 30 seconds, starting with Paul Jessop here.
Good morning, I'm Paul Jessop. I run my company, County Analytics, out of a place near London. I have a number of clients around the media and technology sector, and I guess what I do mostly is identity management, codes for things, giving stuff numbers.
Giving stuff numbers. Well done. And thank you for keeping it well under 30 seconds.
Morning. My name is Robert Norton. I run a company called Verisart. We apply blockchain technology for next generation of standards for certification of artworks and collectibles. Former to this, I was CEO of a company called Saatchi Online and also a company called Sedition. Thank you.
I'm Kevin McCoy. I'm the CEO, co-founder of Monograph, which is a blockchain-based media company here in New York. I'm a professor at NYU in the art department where I run digital practices, and I'm a practicing artist.
Great. Greg, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. My name is Greg McMullen. I'm a lawyer by training, and in a past life, I did class action litigation. But now I am chief policy officer for a company called BigchainDB. We started off as a scribe doing an online blockchain copyright registry for art and are now developing BigchainDB. And I'm also the director of Interplanetary Database.
Right. So, Greg, you were breaking up just a little. Right. So you were breaking up just a little bit there. But while the technology is sort of working.
Version of BigchainDB.
Okay, Greg. Hi there. So while the technology is sort of working, and I'm going to shut up and not interrupt you this time. Before I ask the first question, I want to just explain that since your signal was breaking up a bit and it may be broken up again now.
I just turned off my video, so hopefully it'll be clearer if you can do without the pleasure of looking at my face.
Okay. Well, that'll help. So Greg is director of the among other things the IPDP Foundation. The Interplanetary Database. Now, I love the name of that, but before we get to our panelists who are here in person this morning, let me just ask you, what's wrong with the centralized internet? There's a lot of talk when we talk about rights technology and the blockchain in particular about the need for many things to become decentralized. So what's wrong with this, the way things are today?
Well, my idea of what's wrong is that on the centralized internet, you don't set the rules. There are some really great services, but if you want to use them, you have to play by those rules. And sometimes those rules are set to kind of the lowest common denominator of standards around the world. And I think the really interesting stuff, the really exciting innovation on the internet always happened at the edges. So we need to have a decentralized net to allow that innovation to happen. And that's what we're trying to do with IPDB.
Okay. Robert, a question for you. Many of us are from the music or the film and TV business. And so we are used to working with those kinds of creative works. I wonder if you can explain how a physical thing, a work of art or a collectible, can be certified and verified as the real thing in this network context.
Sure. Well, if you think about artwork certification,
I think it's the Skype.
That's the Skype. All right.
So do we need to, like,
mute? He's got to mute his mic.
Can you mute that, or is Greg can mute himself? Oh, he can do it. Okay, Greg can do it.
Yeah.
Okay. So if you think about artwork certification, it's actually three things. It's really the certificate, which has up to now really been a piece of paper, often quite underlooked piece of paper in the art world, hence the difficulty for reselling works in a secondary market for individuals. And then secondly, it's the provenance, which is the history of that piece of paper or the history of the object as it changes hands. And thirdly, there's the registry, right? Like, which body is it, the artist's estate, the museum, the foundation that's actually authenticating these claims? Now, this is fine up to a point where you trust your gallery and you're going in there and you're looking at a piece of paper and there's a relationship based on trust. Where it starts to fall down is in this kind of growing area of online transactions where, you know, you're seeing, you know, people feeling more and more comfortable buying higher priced purchases directly on the internet. Now, one of the things they can't do is real-time verification of provenance without knowing who the trusted registry contact is in order to go check that. So one of the really interesting things that the blockchain enables us to do is really to create these permanent, private, secure, auditable, irrefutable records. And if the artist is creating them at the outset of their work, then they're actually building kind of categorical certification of their work, and they're making it much more difficult for fraudulent activity or fakes to enter the marketplace. So when you go to the next kind of question, say, well, how then specifically do you relate that to the collectible object in question? There's tons of different sort of technologies out there in terms of synthetic DNA or invisible watermarking or electromagnetic spectral imaging. I mean, you can kind of take your pick, and there'll be some objects that require higher sort of checks, so to speak, that the artist might choose or that the individual might choose. But at the core, it's really about a record. And if you can basically believe in the validity of the record, then you'll feel much more comfortable in the transaction of objects. So for us, we see the importance of record keeping not only in terms of empowering the creators, but also liberating the collectors in terms of having more liquidity when it comes to the resale of their works in an online market.
So is there sufficient trust in the underlying technologies that is shared amongst the various participants in the physical object value chain, let's call it, in order for a market to develop around the space that you've defined for yourself? I mean, clearly there is. You're doing it, but I'd like to.
When you say the underlying technologies, you're talking about the different imaging technologies for verifying the object. You're talking about generally the blockchain as a decentralized transaction protocol for the creation of these certificates.
I think we're talking, well, my question is more about the imaging technology.
Well, I mean, there's a huge, as with kind of any, different sort of academic ways of cataloging and referencing objects, there's a huge ton out there. I was actually talking at the Authentication and Art Symposium at The Hague a few months back. I think you'll start to see massive advances in different sort of tools. I mean, in the UK, you're seeing some companies that are actually kind of bringing out the box solutions right now, particularly for people who are using print multiples in order to create a sort of DNA reference point on the print material itself. We're kind of agnostic, actually, about these technologies because I think they're going to change a lot. I mean, what our biggest challenge is actually explaining to people what the blockchain is and why this is actually useful as a basis for building these certificates. And what we're sort of finding is that, you know, thanks to a few recent deals, so for example, we signed Shepard Fairey, who's our first fully integrated artist, that's all his work is now using VerisArt certification as a way of certifying and then ultimately people being able to verify those objects. And this is really significant because Shepard is a great example of an artist that not only has a kind of fine art collectible market, but also has a very globally recognized secondary market. You can go onto Amazon or eBay and you can see his sign prints for sale. In addition to that, we're doing the pilot program with the Donald Judd Foundation for the whole catalog resume of his prints. And our aim right now is really just to showcase how this technology is really being rooted in real-world examples with well-known artists who actually see the benefit of protecting their market, not just now, but for generations to come.
So it sounds like the technology itself is relatively non-controversial in the domain that you're working in.
I don't want to ascribe and monograph, but I think all of us would probably say that we embrace the notion of the Bitcoin blockchain in terms of what it allows us to move from, which is basically one person's word against another without having to trust those individuals. And now what we can do is, build on the back of a system that's designed for distributed trust between one or more players and allow those records to have permanence. And I think that, what that notion of kind of permanence or longevity is a thing that I find rings truest with the artists that we speak to. The fact that they don't want their authorship to be decoupled from their works, the fact that they don't want in futures to come their market to be affected by, you know, fraudulent activity, and ultimately really kind of just a straightforward empowering message across the board.
If I could jump in here for a second. I just have to take issue with one point. We don't think that the Bitcoin blockchain has what it takes in order to be this registry. The scalability issues with the Bitcoin blockchain prevent it from being a useful global rights registry. And I think quite quickly, we with the Scribe hit the limits of the Bitcoin blockchain, and we're finding that we actually couldn't take on projects that we wanted to. So developing BigchainDB and eventually IPDB has really been a big part of addressing those issues.
Greg, while you have the mic, can you talk a bit about how the IPDP intends to enable new applications? We understand that IPDP is still at a fairly early testing stage, but how are you intending to enable new applications and work across content types and industries?
Basically, what we see it doing is serving as a platform for people to build their own applications on top of. So we feel that there have been a lot of ideas for blockchain, but the technology hasn't been ready to hit internet scale to handle the number of transactions per second that you really need in order to do something truly useful. So that's really the role that we see IPDB filling, is providing this off-the-shelf, ready-to-use database that anyone can just jump on right away and start using, and using at scale.
Okay, thanks. Paul, this is a panel that is nominally about registration of creative works. It's an area that you've spent a fair amount of time in over this last couple of decades. First question for you is about copyright registration. And in the modern world, is copyright registration indeed the only kind of registration that matters, or are there alternative forms of registration that are just as, or maybe even more robust?
Yeah, well, the first comment is that I'm not going to be one of the people going out to the lobby to get my continuing legal education, because I'm an engineer, not a lawyer. But as you say, been knocking around with too many lawyers for too long. Copyright registration, there are better qualified people to talk about in this room than me, but it's going to be a lot of work at an international level to change the status quo. But I don't think we need necessarily to focus on that exclusively, because there's lots of other reasons to run registries, to do registration, other than just to convince the copyright authorities that your copyright is valid. And I think the first, those is when I started talking out at the beginning, it's about giving numbers to things. If you have a registry that associates, that binds, that creates some persistence in bringing together some stuff, an artwork, a piece of creativity, an artifact, whatever, with an identifier for it, which can be linked to data about it, then that in itself brings value. And indeed, without it, it's not clear how anybody can exploit that value, because they don't know what they're dealing in. And there's a plethora of technologies that do that, and we've heard about some of them. You either modify the artifact itself by doping it with something, or scratching it or modifying it in some way, or you measure it in some way as a fingerprint or an image or a digest or whatever. And you use one of those things to bind that entity with its identification. And then you can build all sorts of cool stuff about copyright, about rights management, about ownership, about trading, about downstream rights. And they can't really exist reliably without that initial stage of identification, of registration. Somebody's got to be able to access and say, I believe in this. I trust this. We've heard a lot about trust. But what are we trusting? Are we trusting the database? Because that seems to be what the blockchain's about. Or are we trusting the data that's put into the blockchain, into the database? That's a distinction I'm not seeing clearly made.
You have spent a fair amount of time, Paul, on ISRC in particular, and the implementation of ISRC in various territories around the world, but in particular, the one that we are in now. And I wonder if you can talk for a minute about what ISRC is for everyone who's here who may not be from music in particular, and what role ISRC may have going forward as we talk about implementing these other various underlying technologies in a more decentralized way of conducting transactions for creative works over the network.
So ISRC is the International Standard Recording Code. It's managed, it's published effectively by ISO in Geneva, the International Organization for Standardization. And it gives a 12-character code to a sound recording. And it's run out of London by the International Federation of the Phonographic Industry. And I run the US entity. I know it's strange that a Brit runs the US, but that's the way it is. One of the things the internet is, you can run these things from around the world. Nobody knows where you are. And as long as you say sidewalk instead of pavement, you get away with it. These codes, in this case, are allocated, or they're assigned, as we say, by the owners. So the record company or the self-releasing artist creates a recording. They give it a number according to a set of rules. And at the moment, that's it. There's no obligation to put it into a central database. A bunch of people would like there to be such an obligation. Another bunch of people from other parts of the industry would like to ensure there is no such obligation. If you want me to talk about who those people are, you're going to have to buy me beer at the end of the day. But de facto, those codes get put into databases and registries on a national level, and then they can usually be looked up. And if they can't, we're working on that. So here in the US, Sound Exchange, a client of mine, one of the sponsors, estimable sponsors of this event, they have a portal where you can look up the identity of a particular recording, look up its code, and then you can be reasonably sure that if you use that code, that's what it means. So that is, if you like, the binding between the data and the identifier, but it doesn't bind it to the recording itself. So you can have two different people say that this is the code for this recording, and it's a different code. And in order to get more reliability on that, you need to use one of the technologies we were talking about. We're not there yet. We don't have that. But that's a good lesson for planning and designing systems for other media types. Other media types are well represented in the movie industry. There's IDA, the Entertainment ID Registry, which I had a small role in sort of germinating at the beginning. That works really well, but it's based on the digital object identifier, another one one of the hats. I have hats as well, Larry. I have lots of them. I get charged excess baggage sometimes for bringing them all. Then there are the book industry has the ISBN. It's a product identifier, slightly different, but it really works. You really can't get a book through the point of sale system in Barnes & Noble unless you've got an ISBN and its barcode on the back. It's just the way you do business in books. Similarly, in periodicals, the serial number, ISSN. But there's gaps. Photography, visual arts doesn't really have yet a recognized viable system. There's a group called the Plus Coalition, which is trying to do it. It's been trying to do it for quite a long time. We wish them well, but it hasn't emerged yet. Because I think mostly because of disorganization in the industry or lack of coherent organization of people to push things, communicate it, and explain that it's valuable. It'll no doubt come along soon.
Kevin.
Kevin.
Wow, that's quite an echo. Kevin, you are a working artist and a teacher, and now an entrepreneur. And I wonder how your work as a creator led to your going down the entrepreneurial path that you're on now. And I do have some questions about Monograph in particular, but could you describe what gave rise to you starting this business?
I think all my art friends are asking the same question. and it's an interesting question. And I think that before all these things, I'm an artist, and the kind of art that I'm doing is collaborative artwork. So there is no joint. There's a joint signature, there's a joint authorship built into the essence of the work that I do. My work is media-based, meaning it's, you know, in theory, infinitely reproducible. And I did a lot of work based on appropriation, you know, kind of, you know, ripping off other people's work as the basis for, creating the work that we were producing. So in many ways, it's 180 degrees opposite of the kind of purview of the world that I'm in now. But I think that in many ways, the answer is really simple. It's just born out of necessity and a desire to tackle this challenge of, or identify, a solution to this problem of attribution, of ownership, and of value, and seeing seeing the problems that I was having, that my friends were having, and trying to address that really is it's really as simple as that. And then in terms of the kind of tasks of the entrepreneur, in some ways aren't that different than the tasks of the artist, right? You're kind of thinking about, you're kind of identifying this state of affairs in the world. You're kind of looking at the world, looking at the landscape, and responding in some way, and trying to form some sort of put some sort of frame around things, make that intelligible to people. When you're making a product, or a platform, or a business, there's questions of utility that are different than when you're making an artwork. So there's differences there. But I have found that my life as an artist has been more or less suitable to an entrepreneur, as long as you have some colleagues that can deal with the accounting, not an accountant.
And you have that, right?
Yes, I do. Okay. Actually, they'd usually dump all that work on me, so I've done that too. So Monograph's emerged out of my art practice, out of the concerns that I saw in the art world, out of the kind of intellectual and creative interests that I had, and it's been. Like artwork, where you start on this path and it goes in all these kind of strange directions, and you end up in a spot where it's kind of unbelievable compared to where you started from. That's also the case.
So Paul Jessup was just talking about the unique identifiers around the sound, many of you know that in music there are fundamentally two buckets of copyright. There is the right that accrues to the performer or the owner of the sound recording. There is also the bucket that is related to the underlying musical composition, the song itself. And in the world, and especially in the modern pop music world, there can be, and typically are, many co-writers and indeed many co-publishers that own or can claim a stake in the underlying musical composition, adding layers and layers of additional complexity on these particular problems that we're addressing now. Monograph, I understand, is working with the Dot Blockchain Music Initiative on this particular aspect, and as well, smart contracts. And I wonder, Kevin, if you can comment on that engagement.
Yeah, sure. I mean, and that was, Benji Rogers is driving that project. And he, as he was formulating, speaking early on about that idea and formulating it, he, many times in public, looked to Monograph and looked to what we had set up to date and saw, said that Monograph, saw in Monograph a kind of early prototype of the things that he was talking about, and saw the kind of directions that we were going as steps in the right direction. So through mutual acquaintances, we got together, and then now, not myself personally, but Chris C, my co-founder, my CTO, has been working closely with them as those ideas are developed further. And I'll let Benji speak more about where that project is right now. But I think that the music industry is a really complex industry from a rights perspective, and blockchain has a long way to go in executing on its path. But we're going to be supporting that we are and will be supporting it as it rolls out, and we'll be ready to kind of have a first implementation of it, shortly, soon. It's pretty exciting. It's pretty cool.
If I could jump in on that, one of our projects recently has been with an organization called the Coalition of Autonomous Legal Applications, or COALA. And we've been working with them, with IPFS, and with Ujo Music on something we're calling the COALA IP specification. And it's kind of an effort to develop an actual usable specification for representing all intellectual property rights and all possible transfers and licenses. And it sounds like a very big project, but we're building on the work done by the LCC. So we're trying essentially to create a format for representing this data in the smart contracts that will be managing these rights, and will be doing things like breaking up revenue into these multiple complicated licensing systems, and down the line to all of the people entitled to rights. So we invite everyone to check out the COALA IP spec when we release it in a few weeks.
Greg, there are potentially big governance issues in running a decentralized system. You've defined the notion of a caretaker in your system, and I wonder if you can talk about what a caretaker is and how this actually works.
Sure. So unlike the Bitcoin blockchain, where anyone at all can join and be a miner, we rely on a federated model where it's one organization, one vote. And we call the organizations that have the votes caretakers. So we're handpicking them for now. Right now, there are certain requirements that we put on these organizations. The first is that they all have to have the long-term interest of the internet at heart. And then half of them have to be not-for-profit, and no more than half can be in any given country. And that's to avoid capture by either financial interests or by bad laws in one jurisdiction. So we're putting a lot of thought into the things that could go wrong in the network and making sure that the organizations we put in place to make the decisions about how to handle those things are up to the task.
It sounds like that you've observed the first 20 or so years of how the internet has evolved, and that you are building in a structure to ensure that decentralization continues, assuming that your project is successful. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. We started off modeling the system kind of loosely on the way that the DNS was built, with kind of distributed servers around the world. And then we've tried to learn lessons from the Bitcoin scaling debate, and more recently from the I guess there's no other way to put it, but the disaster with the DAO, where $50 million was stolen from a decentralized blockchain system because of an error in a smart contract. So we're trying to make sure that we avoid those pitfalls and look ahead to see what other ones might be waiting for us.
Okay, thanks, Greg. Back over to Robert. A question for you. I think many of us that are here today are curious about the art market in particular, and what lessons we may take from the way that you are addressing the development of the art market as it moves into the network. What challenges are particular to your market that your company and perhaps others are addressing to move things along?
I think if you look at the art market today, you can pretty much pick up the paper during any month and find an aggrieved individual either kind of claiming that the work they bought was not real, or the gallery didn't pay them on time, or galleries kind of knowingly selling kind of fakes, in the case of the kind of Knoedler Gallery here in New York, and the case of selling a fake Rothko. So the art market, I would say, is rather tainted by fraudulent activity. The FBI estimated around $5 billion a year in fraudulent activity across art and collectibles, which is about 10% of the overall art market on an annualized basis. That's kind of extraordinary when you look at the fact that only around $2.5 billion is online. So you've got a situation where an actual market the size of fraudulent activity in that market is 2x the size of the online market at this point. And I think one of the real reasons that is preventing a kind of stronger uplift in online sales for higher price works is the fact that people want more standardization of certification. People want to be able to know that what they're buying is really what they think they're buying, not what somebody says they're buying. And I don't see any way around that when you've got information silos and sort of effectively very badly run on the whole sort of small databases of content that are not designed to be interrogated by individuals over the internet or to even be kind of queried. So I would kind of characterize the art market as kind of between these two areas. One, which is kind of privacy and I would say opacity. And those are things like, you know, the traditional way that it operates today, galleries and necessity for, you know, off the books transactions in some cases, issues of these kind of different information silos that I talked about. On the other hand, you know, you've seen a huge, huge amount of data coming online, and that's not just at a kind of museum level in terms of linked open data policies and the amount of information now that museums are actually making publicly accessible, but also in terms of price databases, in terms of the fact that there's now, you know, easily accessible for free 10 million plus auction records online, and the great work that you're seeing in terms of just image recognition and kind of the works that's being done in terms of you know, Instagram and Google and the ability to kind of like hashtag an artist. And if you're looking at a contemporary artist coming out of university today, they're pretty much building their catalog resume in real time. They don't need to wait till they get to the end of their life and have a gallery turn around and put that catalog resume together, because if their works are being shown, more than likely somebody is going to take a picture of it and put it with the hashtag of that artist's name. So I see there being real opportunity in terms of, you know, what's happening on the sort of side of transparency, which is these kind of like availability of data across different fields. And then in terms of the requirements of opacity, and they're never going to go away. There'll be some collectors, there'll be some artists that are absolutely completely don't want any information about their work to be out there. And, you know, you can find great examples. You can find kind of Gerhard Richter on the side of transparency and pretty much cataloging everything he's done. Then you can find others like Damien Hirst, who catalogs everything, which doesn't make it transparent. It makes it entirely opaque. And I think that what's interesting about the blockchain is that it actually is a technology that really is useful for both sides of the debate in the art world. It's useful on the side of opacity because it's sharing the same cryptographic standards that, you know, for the kind of query about whether or not the Bitcoin blockchain, which by the way is by far the most widely used blockchain out there, whether or not, you know, it meets and might demands of scalability for millions of transactions per second, I don't think that's particularly relevant today in the art world for artists. But what I can tell you is the underlying protocol is proving to be incredibly robust, which is basically the SHA-256 hashing algorithm and the concept of the blockchain itself as the ledger. So we're building on the back of trusted technology. We're using a very small part of it to date, which is effectively its ability to cryptographically hash the data and then generate an open timestamp. And even though that might seem relatively simple, if everybody can agree that something happened at a moment in time, that in itself is groundbreaking with regards to the art world. And so that's our position.
Thank you, Robert. We will go to your questions in just a minute, so if you can give some thought to questions that you may have for one or more of the panelists. But before we get there, I have one, and it is for Paul, but really for all of you. But let's start with Paul here. The question is, Paul, can commercial entities act as registries, or must registries in the near future be decentralized and owned by no one?
I think I'm not sure that's an entirely fair dichotomy, but I see absolutely no reason that commercial entities can't do this registration process if they're trusted. And that trust issue keeps coming back time and time. It means so many different things to different people. And you could, I mean, many of the systems I've talked about today, or we've talked about, are actually run by consortia. And it's the diversity of the consortium that generates the trust. If you're represented on it and there's enough people there whose interests can only be lined up in the right direction and are unlikely to be subverted, then it's worth trusting them. Could a commercial organization do that? Absolutely. And there are plenty of examples of databases, registries that are run for profit. Mm-hmm. There are also examples of registrars who are for profit, but register in a common consortium, publicly owned, publicly administered, whatever model you want to choose, underlying registry. And they do that typically not because there's a vast amount of money to be made in registration, but because you can add added value services to it.
For example?
In the world of ISBN, there is a common system, but nationally, for-profit entities run the what used to be called books in print, and I think sometimes still is. But they will not only give you an ISBN or tell you what an ISBN means, they'll also do bestseller lists and point-of-sale materials to help bookshops sell books. And they do that because there's a clear synergy between the two services. And in one of the areas I'm working on at the moment in visual arts, Oringenious is expecting to be a commercial entity, but expecting to be a registry which is either part of a bigger ecosystem through interoperability or dominant in a particular area so that it's worth using because its scope is big enough. So I see no problem with that.
Greg. Greg, do you have an opposing point of view on this question of commercial entities acting as registrars?
Oh, absolutely. I think the question isn't commercial or not commercial. The question is trusted and not trusted, as we've just heard. I think one unique thing that blockchain brings to the equation is the ability to certify not just my own statements, but also weigh in on what other people are saying. And I could develop a reputation as an arbitrar to say that this registry or this comment by a registry is trustworthy. And if you trust me, you can trust them as well. What I think is really important for all of this, though, if we're going to have multiple commercial registries and multiple public registries, they need to be able to talk to each other. They need to be using open standards for data so the data can flow back and forth easily between them.
Okay, great. Thank you, Greg. Let's go to your questions. Do we have a burning first question of the day, as the mic is wending its way down the room? And
there has to be a question. Yeah,
there
in this
we
room.
Go. There's one from Chris in the back.
That's okay. Good morning. Good morning, Chris Keneally, Copyright Clearance Center, and hence the nature of my question. We were talking here about copyright, but it seems to me most of the discussion is about these issues around provenance and authenticity and trail of ownership. Names have come up of some of the artists involved. Shepard Fairey, of course, very well known for a copyright case that he didn't quite lose it, but he didn't come up very well at the end of it. And I'm thinking, too, of Richard Prince, whose works are authentically Richard Prince's, as long as you agree with the principle that he can just use anybody's work. So I wonder how that legal question of copyright has an impact on the work you're doing, because the other pieces of it are more the commercial part. There's this legal notion of just whether or not, in fact, the work is someone's original piece.
Well, of course, we would have to talk about Richard Prince in this context. And I think that it's important to recognize, I'm not a lawyer, right? So let's just put that disclaimer out there right away. But copyright is statutory, right? I mean, there's a law that sets up the existence of copyright, and then that becomes internationally, international agreements, things like that. And so, no one has that statutory ability except the government. So it's important to, we're all in the shadow of copyright law. And so that law evolves, and now there's flexibility around kind of automatic copyright, things like that. And so the other law that we're all, at least in the States, that we're under is the Uniform Commercial Code, which gives us flexibility to create contracts. And so it's at that contractual level that I think that there's more flexibility. There's nothing wrong with copyright law, and copyright has certain kind of flexibility, but then there's another type of flexibility that happens through contracts. And so I think that any reform or blockchainification or anything that deals with copyright is going to have to involve some sort of statutory procedure, just by definition, I think. And so I think that in some ways maybe that, I don't know, I can't speak for anybody else, maybe that reflects some of the movements in a more contract and commercial orientation is because of that fact.
Yeah, I'd also like to link that to the previous comment that came over the Skype about the need for data standards. And we need data standards for the relationships between things. So an artist appropriates something and includes it. That may be contractual, it may be under the social contract of fair use. But that relationship needs to be documented for a number of reasons, for rights management, for discovery, for historians and archivists and all sorts of reasons. And those data relators was inspired by, includes a clip from, is a performance of. Those things need to be standardized, and we're not really seeing that having properly started yet. And it needs to, for the linked open data to really be linked in a useful way.
But there's also issues about verification of that, in a sense. I could do a song and say Taylor Swift sings on the song, but she's going to say, no, I didn't sing on the song.
And that's going to come down to an issue of reputation management on the person asserting the link.
Yeah.
I mean, somebody mentioned the Linked Content Coalition, LCC, earlier. That builds on some work which says metadata is a link between two things that somebody asserts, which gives you a three-cornered stool, a thing A, thing B, and the person who says there's a link between them. And that may be my car, red, and me, and I say that it's red. And if you think I can't tell one colour from another, then you can downrate my reputation on that issue.
But it's interesting, just as almost like a counterexample to the Richard Prince example in the art world, there's a really interesting case now with Peter Doig, the painter, where he's being sued by someone who owns one of his paintings that says it's his painting, and he's saying it's not my painting. It's like, dude, that's not my painting. And the guy's like, yes, it is. It's your painting. It's a signature that looks kind of like yours, and you painted it when you were 16 and you were in the juvenile detention facility in Northern Canada. And he's like, dude, I was never in the juvenile detention facility in Northern Canada. And now there's going to be a court case in Chicago about that where he has to prove that it's not his work. So we think about the Richard Prince example and the kind of appropriation art tradition is kind of one way, but here's this crazy example of it working in the opposite way where he's trying to disavow that, his gallerist, and he was trying to disavow that that artwork. And and in the end, it's interesting, this is about markets, right? This is happening because that painting, his market is a valuable market, and somebody's holding this artwork that they think that they're going to resell. And in a kind of Peter Thiel way, it's the case is being funded by outside investors that are kind of like funding this thing to see if they can kind of get a piece of it, whatever. But in the end, it's like the value of these works, what value is being preserved, and why is that value being preserved? And so
I'd like to bring this back to copyright. I there was a comment earlier that everything is in the shadow of copyright, but I think it's the other way around, that everything is building on the foundation that's copyright, because none of this stuff would have any value or any reason why you couldn't just take whatever you want if there wasn't a copyright that is created by the government. So I think the really interesting thing that's happening here is the contractual extensions of copyright law to do things that it was never really intended to do, but we want it to do anyway, which is pretty exciting. It's pretty interesting to see the way that blockchain technologies and new registries can extend that.
I think there's obviously the question of the law here, and as far as I'm aware, we haven't had a case of a blockchain record coming to court as an alternative for an artist's proven certificate. And when that happens, and I believe that these records that, Monograph are creating and we're creating are actually better standards of certificates than what are currently offered out there by galleries or by artists themselves on just pieces of paper. I think that when those do come to court, the courts will start to recognize the fact that the blockchain itself provides some irrefutable proof that something happened at a specific time. And you can look at it both in terms of the chain of the timestamps for the accretion of provenance for a record, but also the specifically the public keys that are being used to encrypt the information. So, you know, I don't think we're there yet. I think you're right to flag this kind of point about where the law stands. I mean, I welcome the case that comes to court that actually I think will strengthen our records that we're putting out. And just kind of finally, also to add on that, you know, I think that I don't believe that we're building on the back of copyright. I think copyright's really let most creators down, and I think that's probably, you know, some of the reasons why, you know, we're sitting here. I mean, the very small amount of work is actually sort of registered, particularly in visual arts, with the U.S. Copyright Agency. So, you know, this is the reason. If it was an easier process, if it was a more simple online process to kind of register copyright, I think artists, you know, coming out of, you know, 50,000 artists a year coming out of art schools in America might register their final year shows. I doubt very many of them do, and we really want that to change. And I think that, you know, the role of entrepreneurial startups like ourselves has a big part to play in that.
We're going to have to leave it there. Please join me in thanking Robert, Kevin, Greg, and my friend Paul Jessup. We're going to end on time and set that bar for the rest of the day. Thank you all.